And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, today's May 14th, 134th day of the year. 231 days remain till this year's over with. On this day in history, in 1027, Robert II of France named his son Henry I as Junior King of the Franks. 1097, the Siege of Nicaea begins during the First Crusade. 1264, Battle of Lewes. Henry III of England is captured and forced to sign the Mace of Lewes, making Simon de Montfort the effective ruler of England. 1509, Battle of Agnadello. Northern Italy, French forces defeat the Republic of Venice. 1607, English colonies established James Fort, which had become Jamestown, Virginia, the earliest permanent English settlement in the Americas, and I had ancestors there. 1608, the Protestant Union, a coalition of Protestant German states, is founded to defend the rights, land, and safety of each member of against the Catholic Church and the Catholic German states. 1610, Henry IV of France is assassinated by Catholic zealot François de Lavignac, and Louis XIII ascends the throne. 1643, four-year-old Louis XIV, the Sun King, becomes King of France upon the death of his father, Louis XIII. 1747, War of Austrian Succession. British fleet and Admiral George Anson defeats the French at the First Battle of Cape Finisterre. 1796, Edward Jenner administers the first smallpox inoculation. 1800, the 6th U.S. Congress recesses, and the process of moving the U.S. government from Philadelphia to Washington, D.C. begins the next day. 1804, William Clark and 42 men depart from Camp Dubois to join Meriwether Lewis at Fort Charles, Missouri. This marks the beginning of the Lewis and Clark Expedition's historic journey up the Missouri River. 1811, in Paraguay, Pedro Juan Caballero, Fulgencio Yegros, and Jose Gaspar Rodriguez de Francia start actions to depose the Spanish government. 1836, Treaty of Velasco is signed in Velasco, Texas. 1863, American Civil War. The Battle of Jackson takes place on this date. 1868, the Bosnian War. Battle of Utsunomiya Castle ends with former Tokugawa shogunate forces withdrawn northward. 1870, the first game of rugby in New Zealand is played in Nelson between Nelson College and the Nelson Rugby Football Club. 1878, the last witchcraft trial held in the U.S. begins in Salem, Massachusetts, after Lucretia Brown, an adherent of Christian Science, accused Daniel Spofford of attempting to harm her through his mental powers. 1879, the first group of 163 Indian indentured laborers arrives in Fiji aboard the Leonidas. 1913, Governor of New York, William Seltzer, approves the charter for the Rockefeller Foundation, which begins operations with a $100 million donation from John D. Rockefeller. 1913, $100 million was good money. 1918, Camp Town Mayor Sir Harry Hands, inaugurates a two-minute silence. Wonder if his hands were hairy. 1931, five unarmed civilians are killed in the Adelin shootings as the Swedish military is called in to deal with protesting workers. And that's one way to deal with a protesting worker, shoot him. 1935, the Constitution of the Philippines is ratified by popular vote. 1939, Lina Medina becomes the youngest confirmed mother in medical history at the age of 5. Wonder who she was getting it on with. 1940, World War II. Rotterdam, Netherlands is bombed by the Luftwaffe of Nazi Germany despite a ceasefire. About 900 people are killed. And it destroyed the historic city center. 1943, World War II. A Japanese submarine sinks the AHS Centaur off the coast of Queensland. 1948, Israel was declared to be an independent state and a provisional government was established. Immediately after the declaration, Israel was attacked by the neighboring Arab states. And this begins the 1948 Arab-Israeli War, where the Israelis put some hurt on the Arabs. 1951, trains run on the Talleyrand Railway in Wales for the first time since preservation, making it the first railway in the world to be operated by volunteers. 1955, Cold War. 8 communist bloc countries, including the Soviet Union, signed a mutual defense treaty. It's called the Warsaw Pact. 1961, Civil Rights Movement. A white mob twice attacks a Freedom Riders bus in Anniston, Alabama, before firebombing the bus and attacking the civil rights protesters who flee the burning vehicle. 1970, Andreas Bader is freed from custody by Ulrike Meinhof, Gudrun Insulin, and others. It's a pivotal moment in the formation of the Red Army faction. 1973, Skylab, the U.S.'s first space station, is launched. 1977, a Dan Air Boeing 707 leased to IAS Cargo Airlines crashes on approach to Lusaka International Airport. It's now known as Kenneth Kaunda International Airport in Lusaka, Zambia. 6 people are killed. 1980, Salvadoran Civil War. The Sumpo River Massacre occurs in Chalatenango in El Salvador. 1988, Carrollton Bus Collision. A drunk driver traveling the wrong way on Interstate 71 near Carrollton, Kentucky, hits a converted school bus carrying a church youth group. 27 die in the crash and ensuing fire. 2004, the Constitutional Court of South Korea overturns the impeachment of the President Roh Moo-hyun. Also in 2004, Rico Linhas Arias Flight 4815 crashes into the Amazon rainforest during approach to Eduardo Gomez International Airport in Manaus, Brazil. 33 people are killed. 2008, Battle of the Piccadilly Gardens in Manchester City Center between Zenit supporters and Ranger supporters and the Greater Manchester Police. 39 police officers are injured, 1 police dog is injured, and 39 are arrested. 2010, Space Shuttle Atlantis launches on STS-132. That's a mission to deliver the first shuttle-launched Russian ISS component, the Rashvet. It's originally slated to be the final launch of Atlantis before Congress approved STS-135. And in 2012, Agni Air Flight CHT crashes in Nepal after a failed go-around. 15 people are killed. A lot of births and deaths on this date in history. Let's see what we got in the way of holidays and observances. Christian Feast Day, Boniface of Tarsus, Engelmann of Velsen, Matthias the Apostle in the Roman Catholic Church and the Anglican Communion, Michael Garakultis, Mochutu of Lismore in the Roman Catholic Church, Victor and Corona. Earliest day was the first day of Sanja Matsuri can fall. May 21st is the latest. It's actually celebrated on the third weekend of May in Tokyo. Flag Day in Paraguay. Hastings Banda's birthday in Mwali. National Unification Day in Liberia. And the first day of Zumo Teyashe Shrine Grand Festival. Well, we're going to see what else there is wandering around out there. All righty. In 649, Theodore I ends his reign as Catholic Pope. 1027, I talked about Robert II of France. 1264, Battle of Luz, the Second Barons' War. Simon de Montfort the Younger, Earl of Leicester, defeats English King Henry III. 1483, on this date, coronation of Charles VIII of France, also known as Charles the Affable. 1509, Battle of Agnadello. French forces under Louis XII defeat the Venetians in northern Italy. 1576, the Dutch Council of State replaced by the Council of Beurotten. 1607, English colonies, as I said, established the first permanent English settlement in America at Jamestown. Unbeknown to them, they landed amidst the worst drought in 800 years. 1638, Admiral Adam Westerwolt conquers Batticaloa in Ceylon. In 1664, Turkish Grand Vizier Kapurlu Fazıl Ahmed attacks 120,000 Donahue soldiers. 1702, England and Netherlands declare war on France and Spain. 1702, Swedish troops under King Charles XII occupy Warsaw. 1474, a British fleet under Admiral George Anson defeats the French. 1767, the British government disbands Americans' import duty on tea. They could tax us for buying it. We couldn't tax them for importing it. Makes sense. 1787, delegates gather in Philadelphia to draw up the U.S. Constitution. 1811, Paraguay gains independence from Spain on this date. It's known as National Day. 1842, the Illustrated London News, the world's first illustrated weekly newspaper, begins publication on this date. 1853, Gale Borden, land surveyor, newspaper publisher, and inventor, patents his process for condensed milk. And you've heard of Borden's milk, I'm sure. 1861, the Canalis meteorite, an 859-gram chondrite-type meteorite, strikes the Earth near Barcelona, Spain. 1862, Adolf Nicole of Switzerland patents the chronograph. 1874, the first admission charge at a football game. Harvard beats the University of McGill in Montreal 3-0. 1878, Vaseline is patented on this day in 1878. U.S. patent 127,568. 1884, the Anti-Monopoly Party forms in the U.S. I wonder what they got so upset about a board game for. 1889, the National Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Children, NSPCC, is launched in London. 1890, British sailor David Beatty is promoted to sub-lieutenant, went on to become Admiral of the Fleet. 1894, a fire in Boston bleachers spreads to 170 adjoining buildings. 1897, Great Britain signs a treaty with Emperor Menelik II of Abyssinia. You also know it as Ethiopia. 1906, the flagpole at White Sox Ballpark breaks during the pennant raising. That was considered a bad sign. 1908, the first passenger flight in an airplane took place on this date. 1910, Canada authorizes the issuing of silver dollar coins. 1918, Sunday baseball is made legal in Washington, D.C. 1921, in the Italian election, Mussolini's fascists obtained 29 parliamentary seats. 1932, a We Want Beer parade took place in New York City. 1938, England's soccer team beats Nazi Germany's team 6-3. I wonder what happened to the Nazis when they got home. On this day in 1938, The Adventures of Robin Hood, starring Errol Flynn and Olivia de Havilland, is released. In her younger days, she was quite the stunner. In 1940, the British Local Defense Volunteer Group forms. It's an armed citizens' militia designed to support the British Army during the Second World War, later renamed the Home Guard. 1940, Admiral Johannes Fersner from the Royal Dutch Navy leaves his home for England. 1940, there's a German breakthrough at Sedan. 1941, 3,600 Parisian Jews are arrested by the Nazis. 1944, 91 German bombers attack Bristol. 1944, General Rommel, Spedale, and von Stupnagel attempt to assassinate Hitler. If he hadn't shot Rommel, they might have won the war. 1945, Kamikaze Zero strikes U.S. aircraft carrier Enterprise. 1945, physician Joseph Hamilton injects a misdiagnosed cancer patient by the name of Albert Stevens with 131 KBQs of plutonium without telling him. Stevens lived another 20 years, surviving the highest known accumulated radiation dose in any human. Who knows what would have happened? Yeah, let's see. 1948, Israeli radio station KOL Israel first broadcast on this date. 1948, Jordan's Arab League captures Atarat, north of Jerusalem. Also in 1948, the U.S. grants Israel de facto recognition. 1948, Golda Meir is one of the signatories of Israel's independent declaration. She was also the fourth prime minister. 1949, President Truman signed a bill establishing a rocket test range at Cape Canaveral. 1951, Ernie Kovacs show. I remember it well. TV variety debuted on NBC. 1960, USSR launched the first unmanned space capsule. 1962, politician, writer, and ex-president of Yugoslavia, Milovan Djalic, sentenced to 5 years in prison. 1963, Kuwait becomes the 111th member of the United Nations. 1965, the Chinese detonate their second atomic bomb. 1968, the Czech government announces liberalizing reforms into Alexander Dubček. 1969, abortion and contraception are legalized in Canada. 1973, the Supreme Court approves equal rights to females in the military. 1975, U.S. forces raid Cambodian island of Koh Tang to free the Mayaguez, which was a ship. 1976, Lowell Thomas ends his 46-year run as a radio network reporter. 1980, Department of Health and Human Services opens for business. 1986, Netherlands Institute for War documentation publishes Anne Frank's diary. Well, and finally, on this day in 1987, a Colt revolver. It was a peacemaker. Made in 1873, sells for $242,000. That's a good chunk of change for a pistol. Alrighty. Well, we've been talking about creatures of the night, and we're going to talk about some more of them. One of the most famous, of course, is the Jersey Devil. The story about the so-called Jersey Devil is almost as legendary as the tales that surround Bigfoot, the Loch Ness Monster, and the Chupacabra. Now, the story of the Jersey Devil actually dates back to 1735 into the heart of New Jersey's Pine Barrens. Pine Barrens covers about 2,000 square miles. But it's dominated by masses of conifer trees. According to Ken Gerhardt, like most remote and uninhabited ranges, the barrens are often steeped in mystery, with many colorful stories about its history and its lore. And that all brings us full circle back to the Jersey Devil. According to the tale, a certain Mother Leeds, a sinister figure who lived in the Pine Barrens, was the cause of all the mystery and mayhem. When pregnant with her 13th child, she put a curse on the unborn child that ensured that it took on a hideous form. Highly appropriate that on the night that Mother Leeds went into labor, and there was a wild storm that battered the area, shook the trees, and filled the skies with crashing thunder and huge lightning bolts. Well, as the storm got worse and worse and reached its peak, the demon baby was born. Although baby is and hardly an apt term to use, the hideous child was described as having leathery wings, a horse-shaped head, and hooves instead of feet. Now, the Jersey Devil wasted no time in making good its escape. It opened its wings, took to the air, and shot out of the chimney of Mother Leeds' house. Made a new home for itself in the dense and mysterious Pine Barrens. Now, the story sounds like the stuff of legend and nothing else, but there is no denying the fact that people who live in the area reported astonishing encounters with something malevolent and hideous they believe is the Jersey Devil. For example, on December 14, 1925, the Bridgeton Evening News ran an article entitled "The Dog-Like Beast or Ate Seven Chickens Before a Shot Killed It. Hundreds failed to identify the species." According to that article, what resembled a Jersey Devil as much as anything else was shot and killed near Bacon's Neck last week. It was viewed and even photographed by hundreds over the weekend. Nobody could name the creature with any certainty. William Hyman, who manages the old Glassbell farm for Barton Sharp, was awakened before daybreak by a racket in his chicken coop. Well, he jumped up, got dressed, went out carrying his gun, and as a creature ran out of the coop with a chicken in its mouth, he fired and fur flew, but the animal ran on. Well, since he was up at 4, Hyman decided to get to work. Soon the chickens called again. He ran to the coop in time to see that same creature leaving with another bird. He fired again in the semi-darkness but failed to kill it. But this time he followed the creature out into the meadow. Half mile from the house, he caught sight of it again, and the animal turned and attacked him. Well, he blazed away, and finally the creature fell. He went over to it, and it was dead. About the size of an Airedale dog, it has black, crinkly hair. On its hind feet, it had 4 webbed toes. Didn't run like a dog, but hopped more like a kangaroo. Front quarters are higher than its head, which crouched as it ran. Its rear teeth are prong-like, the upper ones fitting into the center of the 4-prong lower ones. Its eyes are still a bright yellow, and its jaws unlike a dog, wolf, or even a coyote. So there you have the description as given by visitors on the farm, who added that despite the weather, the dead animal still limber instead of being stiff. It took and apparently ate 7 chickens that night. Same night it was eventually killed. Now, guesses include one that suggests that it might be a dog, long starved, half wild. Others suggest it was a cross between a dog and a wolf, but most of those who've seen it don't have any guess to give. Anyone certain of the way the Jersey Devil looks is requested to view the beast and give a report. 12 years later, July 28, 1937, Jersey Evening Bulletin entertained and possibly terrified its readers with a feature headlined, The Devil Went Down to Jersey. According to the story, Dateline Downingtown, July 28th, Chester County's green and verdant countryside was trying to shake itself back into shape of normalcy today after an all-night hunt for the 1937 version of the old Jersey Devil. Armed with guns and clubs and led by a pack of dogs whose barking in the moonlight almost reached blood-curdling heights at times, a hastily formed posse of 2 dozen farmers skipped their sleep last night to scout the hills and fields for a bounding critter with huge eyes. But this strange creature was reported shortly after 9 p.m. by Sidney Ladley, a paper mill employee who lives near Milford Mills, just north of here. Rushing into town with bated breath, he and his wife and Miss Chester Smith, a neighbor, told they had seen the creature on a back road near their home just as dusk was sitting down over the hills. They said it leaped across the road in front of my car. It was about the size of a kangaroo, according to Ladley. Covered with hair 4 inches long, and it hopped like a kangaroo. And its eyes, oh, what eyes. And Ms. Ladley at that point jumped in and said, and it jumped. And according to Miss Smith, it jumped right in front of us. Descriptions were enough, so within half an hour, more than 20 neighboring farmers had gotten their shotguns, unleashed their hounds, and were abroad in the moonlight, resolving to track that creature down to its lair. Well, today's sightings of the Jersey Devil are far less prevalent and terrifying than they were in decades past. That doesn't mean, though, that you should let your guard down if one day you find yourself deep in the heart of the New Jersey Pine Barrens. That deadly creature just might be circling silently overhead and getting ready to launch a terrifying attack, don't you know? Well, from the Jersey Devil, let's turn to a particularly creepy little critter that's said to become known as the Lincoln Imp. It's actually a carved figure that sits prominently on Lincoln Cathedral in England. The story of the devilish imp is a memorable one, though, and well known to the cathedral staff. And according to them, tales of how he came to be perched there have emerged over time. There's several versions of the story, though. All of them share the same basic plot. Satan sent the imp to Lincoln Cathedral to cause trouble. The imp carried out his orders and began destroying the angel choir. And when an angel appeared to prevent him causing further mayhem, the imp jumped up onto the pillar and threw rocks at the angel. And in order to put a stop to his mischievousness, the angel turned the imp into stone. Don't you know? Well, some versions of the imp story date back to the 14th century and are contemporary with the construction of the angel choir. The presence of the imp in the cathedral acts as a moral symbol and is a constant reminder that ultimately good will triumph over evil. That shows they've never been in El Paso. Lincoln's imp is a well-known emblem of the cathedral and the city to the extent that it's been adopted as the symbol of Lincoln and by the 1930s was established as the nickname of the local football team. The imp began a commercial life in the late 19th century, and local jeweler Jamie Usher and Son began advertising a range of charming and very appropriate souvenirs of Lincoln, featuring the imp. Now, the Lincoln imp is merchandise is still available today in the cathedral shop. Recently, Lincoln Cathedral received a surprise when a carved wooden replica of the famous imp was received through the mail, all the way from Western Australia. And add to the mystery, the letter accompanying the imp was tantalizingly brief, stating it was being returned as its custodian had died. It was removed on behalf of the cathedral during one of the wars. Experts on the cathedral's works department believe the imp is a Victorian copy and probably at least 100 years old. Well, psychic questing is a subject that was deeply popular in the UK from the late 1970s into the early 1990s. It's the process by which ancient buried artifacts can be located via psychic phenomena. Andrew Collins' book, The Black Alchemist and the Second Coming, have long fascinated folks and are perfect examples of how psychic questing plays a major role in the discovery of priceless old relics. But it's Martin Keatman and Graham Phillips' sequel to their book, The Green Stone, called The Eye of Fire, that we need to look at here, which contains a strange and intriguing reference to Ranton Abbey, which is situated on the very briefest of trips away from the infamous haunted bridge where the man-monkey for so long made its dark and diabolical home. Ranton Abbey, known more correctly as the Augustinian Priory, was founded by Robert FitzNoel during the reign of Henry Plantagenet, with the construction having been completed by 1150. In the early 19th century, the property became part of the estate of the Anson of Shugborough, latterly the Earls of Lichfield. Today, the abbey is unfortunately in ruins, having been accidentally ravaged and destroyed by fire during the Second World War. This happened while it was occupied by Dutch soldiers. Now, with that said, while much of the Eye of Fire is far beyond the scope of what we're discussing, the relevant data relates to a July 1982 trip to the abbey that the team of investigators in the book took as part of their quest to locate the Eye of Fire discussed in the book's title. Basically, the relevant part of Phillips and Keatman's saga reveal how one of the characters of the book, individual named Mary Heath, created back in the 19th century a monstrous guardian at the abbey whose role is to protect an ancient artifact. One, of course, that plays a vital role in the story. Interestingly, the guardian is described in the book's pages as highly ominous tones and variously as a complete blackness seething within itself, shapeless but at the same time having substance, as an abomination and as a heavy-breathing great beast. The guardian, we come to learn, is a horrendous protector-style thought form, brought into being and roaming around an ancient abode in the heart of Renton. And that's not all. This vile creature was reportedly created by Mary Heath in 1875. How intriguing that an anonymous thought form was created in Renton in 1875, and 4 years later, the man-monkey was seen rampaging around the nearby Bridge 39 on the Shropshire Union Canal. Could it be that Mary Heath's monstrous offspring and the man-monkey were and are still one and the same? Now, admittedly, this is speculative and controversial, but it is a question that has to be asked. Rather, it may offer us a convincing explanation for at least some of the strange creatures that have passed and that continue to pass for the enigmatic phenomena that has become known as the British Bigfoot. You know, Albert Bender was inextricably linked to the enigma of the Men in Black. It was his 1951 and 52 encounters with the Men in Black that led UFO researcher Gray Barker to write the very first book on the darkly clad creatures. It was 1956. They knew too much about flying saucers. Well, for that reason alone, it's unusual that practically every researcher and author who's ever commented on the encounters with the dark-suited ones has overlooked something massively important. His family links to what we would describe as a woman in black. She's a spectral crone with an obsession for nothing less than coins. Well, in 1933, while he was just a child, Bender's mother told him the spine-tingling story of a family ghost. She called it a woman in black. The story revolved around a second cousin of Bender's who, while only 6 years old, moved into a creepy old house with his family. It was a house that sat adjacent to an old abandoned mine shaft. Now, the mine was a downright eerie place filled with angular shadows, old wooden supports that creaked and groaned endlessly, and a multitude of bats and rats, as you might think would call something like that home. It's also a mine in which years earlier it had spotted a young woman slit her throat, and as the blood cascaded down, threw herself into the depths of one of the darkened old shafts. Eventually, her battered and torn body was finally recovered and taken to the house in which Bender's cousin lived, before being buried in the local graveyard. According to Bender, the woman was said to have been a definitive witch who lived alone with a great many cats, and she said to prowl about only at night. Well, according to Bender, his cousin wore a coin on an unbroken chain around his neck constantly. He even wore it to bed. After having lived in the house for a few months, his parents noticed his health was failing. He wouldn't eat and claimed he saw a lady in black in his bedroom at night. Of course, he thought it was all nonsense, and he was only dreaming, but soon they began to have sleepless nights when the boy would scream out in his sleep and they'd find it necessary to come and comfort him. Early hours one particular morning, Bender's cousin awoke the family, wailing like a veritable banshee. His parents noticed the coin had been unhooked from the chain and was positioned on the pillow. According to Bender, the boy told his mother and father the lady in black was trying to choke him and take his coin away from him. Now, the local doctor said the whole thing is related to nightmares and nothing else. But, unfortunately, the doctor was soon to be proved wrong. With no end in sight to the nightmare terrors, both parents elected to sleep in the boy's room until things calmed down. On the fourth night, they were woken up by the menacing and horrific sight of a hooded female form, dressed in black with anemic-looking skin, who slowly glided across the room right in the direction of the boy. Bony hand moved slowly down to grasp the coin, at which point the boy's father lit a candle and thrust it in the face of the woman in black. According to Bender, they could see a pale, chalky white face staring back at him. And in an instant, the terrifying hag was gone. And so was the coin. Not surprisingly, the family vacated the house within a week, and the boy, to everybody's relief, quickly recovered. So you can see, in reality, Albert Bender's exposure to the blackest mystery of all did not begin in the early 50s. When he got a visit from three menacing men in black that rivaled anything ever written by his hero, Edgar Allan Poe. It began two decades earlier in the 1930s, when a monstrous woman in black who had a thing for coins and making them disappear walked into a bedroom, grabbed a coin, and vanished. Well, we got some more things to talk about.
Well, from men in black, let's turn our attention to secret societies. You know, a lot of people with interest in the issue of powerful secret societies are familiar with the likes of the Bilderbergers, the Illuminati, the Freemasons, the Cathars, Skull and Bones. But very few, though, will be conversant with an equally powerful body of people called the Tag Harem. Like some other secret societies, this one's populated by people who crave absolute power, massive wealth, and elite standing in society. But it's the way the members of the Tag Harem achieve their goals that places them in their own nearly unique category. Now, this is a centuries-old cult. It exists and operates in stealth in the Highlands of Scotland, and it's done so since at least the 17th century. It uses ancient sacrificial rituals to get just about anything and everything it desires. It's rumored that numerous Scottish politicians, police officers, bankers, actors, doctors, judges, and landowners are just some of the Tag Harem's many and varied members. Miralee Harper is a British researcher who's carefully and deeply studied the history of the Tag Harem. She says, key to the success of the members is an infernal magical sacrifice of cats and rites dedicated to the subterranean gods of pagan times. It's from these gods that the gifts and benefits were solicited. And they were called in the Highlands and the Western Isles of Scotland the Black Cat Spirits. Now, the process of sacrifice was and still is gruesome in the extreme. Isolated and lonely places high in the mountains of Scotland were chosen safely to ensure privacy. Now, secrecy is paramount in these matters. Members arrive in black cloaks and pointed hats at the chosen spot in the dead of night, determined at all times to protect their identities and presence from the outsiders. And then comes the main event. Huge spits are built upon which cats are slowly roasted. And while they're still alive for up to 4 days and nights, during which the operator of the spit is denied sleep or nourishment, aside from the occasional sip of water, don't you know? Supposedly, when the ritual's at its height, from the paranormal, either ether terrifying, huge black cats with glowing red eyes appear before the conjurer, demanding to know what it is that he or she wishes to have bestowed on them. It could be money, it could be influence, or something else. And in return, and in a fashion befitting the likes of Faust, on his or her death, the conjurer agrees to turn over his or her soul to these ancient, mighty gods worshipped by the Tag Harem. Well, now, out of doubt, the one person more than any other who was conversant with the terrible rituals of the Tag Harem was J.Y.W. Lloyd, who wrote in a very well-known 1881 book, The History of the Prince, The Lord's Marcher, and the Ancient Nobility of Pals, Fadog, and the Ancient Lords of Arstal, Sedowin, and Marionid. He became fascinated by the Tag Harem after reading Horace Deuteroscopy, which was the first published book to expose the actions of this heartless group. According to Lloyd, the midnight hour between Friday and Saturday is an authentic time for these terrible practices and invocations. Now, Horace himself presented a terrible image. After the cats were dedicated to all the devils and put into magical sympathetic condition by the shameful things done to them and the agony occasioned to them, one of them was at once put alive onto the spit and amid terrified howlings roasted over a slow fire. A moment that the howls of the one tortured cat ceased in death, another was put on the spit, and for a minute of interval must not take place or they'd control hell. And this continued for more than for the entire 4 days and nights. If the exorcist could hold it out still longer and even until his physical powers absolutely exhausted, he was required to do so. It was after the 4 day period, according to Horace, that infernal spirits appeared in the shape of black cats. These came continually more and more of these cats, and their howlings, mingled with those roasting on the spit, were just terrific. Finally, appeared a cat of a monstrous size with dreadful menace. When the Tag Harem was complete, the sacrificer demanded of the spirits the reward of his offering. This consisted of various things, riches, children, food, clothing. The gift of second sight, which they hadn't had before, was the usual recompense. And they retained that gift of second sight until the day they died. Well, as the 19th century came to its end, though I came to believe that while the legend and cruel and cold reputation of Tag Harem still existed, the group as a fully functional entity did not. He recorded that one of the very last Tag Harem rituals was held on the Scotland Isle on a mull in the early 1800s. He added that the folk of Mull still show the place where Alan McLean, at the time of the encounter, and sacrificial priest stood with his assistant, Lachlan McLean, both men of a determined and unbending character. Now, theirs is reported a frightening midnight ritual held on a cold winter's night under a full moon. According to Lloyd, Alan McLean continued his sacrifice to the fourth day when he was exhausted both in body and mind and sunk in a swoon. But from this day he received a second sight to the time he died, as did also his assistant. In the people, the belief was unshaken that the second sight was a natural consequence of celebrating the Tag Harem. Now there is intriguing data that strongly suggests the Tag Harem is still with us, lurking in the shadows until extending their power and influence. 1922, Carl van Vechten commented on post-19th century Tag Harem activity in a footnote contained in his book, The Tiger in the House. According to his footnote, the night of the day I first learned of the Tag Harem, I dined with some friends who were also entertaining a Swamis, chief of the clan Fergus of Strecker. He informed me that, to the best of his knowledge, the Tag Harem is still celebrated in the Highlands of Scotland. And then there is the account that came from one Donald Johnson, a man born and bred in Scotland, and who, just like his late father, worked as a butler for a powerful and rich family that had its roots in the ancient English country of Staffordshire. According to Johnson, his father was invited by his employers to join an English offshoot of the Tag Harem in the winter of 1982. provided that he was willing to leave his old life and friends behind and fully embrace the Tag Heuer and its teachings. Now, Johnson Sr. is ready to do so, and that is until he witnessed one of those monstrous sacrifices deep in the heart of England's Cannock Chase woods, and on the proverbial dark and stormy night, no less. Johnson Sr.'s decision to walk away quickly was not at all appreciated by the Tag Heuer, and reportedly made explicit threats about what would happen to him if he dared to go public with what he knew and had seen. And such was his fear, he stayed completely and utterly silent on the matter until he told his son Donald in 2010. Donald went public with the story in December of that year out of fear for his own safety. The society of the Tag Heuer, it seems, is still as much up to his terrible tricks as it was 400 years ago. Indeed, power, influence, and wealth are hard to give up or deny. Even if one has to enter into Faustian pacts with ancient earth gods and supernatural black cats to get them. And certainly there are those that would be willing to risk anything to achieve those goals. Let's talk about trolls. Early hours of a winter's morning in 1975 when Barry and Elaine, a married couple, then in their late 20s with two small children, were driving toward their then Slitting Mill, Staffordshire, England home after attending a Christmas party in the nearby town of Pinkridge. As the pair headed toward the small village, its population today, 400 years after its initial foundation, the lady is still less than 300. Their car engine began to sputter, to their consternation and concern, completely died. Having managed to carefully coast the car off the side of the road, Barry proceeded to quickly open the hood and took a look at the engine, even though he had no idea what he was looking at. Didn't appear to be any loose wires. The radiator was not overheating. The check of the car's fuses didn't provide any indication of what might be the problem. But as the family was less than half a mile or so from home at that point, Barry made a decision. He said, "We had a picnic blanket in the boot." That's the British term for the trunk, don't you know? And I got it out, and we got back into the car, and I said to Elaine, "Let's cover you up and the kids with the blanket." They were in the back sleeping. We were only 4 or 6 at the time. He said to his wife, "You stay with them, and I'll run back home, get your car, and pick the three of you up, and then we'll leave my car here. Somebody come look at it in the morning." Well, at one point, though, their plans were thrown into complete and utter disarray. According to Barry, Elaine let out a terrible scream, terrified by the sight of a small figure that ran across the road in front of them at a high rate of speed. She told her husband, "I just saw it at the last second, and then another one followed it, and then a third one. Best way I can describe them is they looked like hairy trolls or something like that. We had some moonlight, and they were like little men with hunchbacks and big crooked noses. Not a stitch on them. Just hair. I'd say they were 4 feet tall. When the third one crossed by us, you could see them at the edge of the trees. Things became very hazy after that, according to Barry. We both know from memory they came forward towards us very slowly, and I thought since they were interested in us and wanted to know who we were. They came very slowly, and it was a bit like we were being hunted. Lane was hysterical with the kids with us. I wasn't far off either. But that's all they remember. Next thing, it's all gone. Nothing. Neither of us remember seeing them go. The next thing was about 2 o'clock, and the car started up just fine. Felt like something had happened to us, but I couldn't quite put my finger on it. But the memory thing's the biggest problem. What was it? I did have a dream later about them surrounding the car, but that's it. And there they were, and we did see them right up by the stone house. Now, that stone house was a large old abode that sits on the edge of the village of Slittingville, and dates back to 1584, 2 centuries prior to the emergence of the village in the 1700s. Well, according to Barry, to this day, and they're both now in their mid-60s, both he and Elaine still feel queasy about the loss of memory they had experienced back in 1975. But he's keen to affirm that he knows, and we know, and we both saw him. Kids don't remember a thing, though. They were horrible little things, all that hair, trolls, goblins, something, but they were there and they were real. Neither Barry nor Elaine has ever experienced any further such incidents or encounters with the unknown. But they've never forgotten those disturbing events deep in the heart of Slitting Mills on a chilly winter night all those years ago, when they dealt with a strange band of hairy trolls. And of course, we have the tulpa. Visualize in your mind, if you will, the fully formed image of a Bigfoot, a werewolf, a huge black dog with glowing lead eyes, even a Yeti. The list goes on and on. And then imagine being able to project that same monstrous imagery externally to the point where your monster of the mind strides out of your imagination into the real world. When it does that, it takes on its own quasi-independent form of life. Although you have to admit it's a very strange form of life. You've just given birth to what the Tibetans know as the tulpa. Creating a mind monster is not without its hazards, though. In fact, it's an action that's almost always filled with danger. Certainly no one knew that more than Dame Alexander David Neal. Born in 1868, David Neal, who lived to the impressive and ripe old age of 100, extensively explored Tibet and immersed herself in its culture and people. And she learned about the Tibetan lore surrounding the tulpa to the extent she decided to try and create one. It was an action that proved costly and almost disastrously so for David Neal. She said, once the tulpa is endowed with enough vitality to be capable of playing the part of a real being, it tends to free itself from its maker's control. And according to Tibetan occultists, this happens nearly mechanically. Just as a child, when his body is completed and able to live apart, leaves its mother's womb. Sometimes the phantom becomes a rebellious son. One hears of uncanny struggles that have taken place between magicians and their creatures, the former being severely hurt or even killed by the creatures they create. I chose for my experiment a most significant character, an insignificant character, a monk, short, fat, of an innocent, jolly type. I proceeded to form the prescribed concentration of thought and other rites. And after a few months, the phantom monk was formed. His form grew gradually fixed and lifelike looking. Became a kind of guest living in my apartment. I then broke my seclusion and started for a tour in my servants and tents. And the monk, as you might imagine, included himself in the party. Though I lived in the open, riding on horseback for miles each day, the illusion persisted. I saw that fat tulpa. Now and then it wasn't necessary for me to think of him to make him appear. The phantom performed various actions of the kind that are natural to travelers and that I had not commanded. For instance, he walked and stopped and looked around him. The illusion was mostly visual, but sometimes I felt as if a robe was lightly rubbed against me, and once a hand seemed to touch my shoulder. The features that I'd imagined when building my tulpa gradually underwent a change. The fat, chubby-cheeked fellow grew leaner. His face assumed a vaguely mocking, sly, malignant look. He became more troublesome and bold. In other words, he escaped my control. Once a herdsman who brought me a present of butter saw the tulpa in my tent and took it for a living llama. I ought to have let the phenomena follow its course, but the presence of that unwanted companion began to prove trying to my nerves. Turned into a daymare. Moreover, I was beginning to plan my journey to Lhasa and needed a quiet brain devoid of other preoccupations, so I needed to dissolve the phantom. I succeeded, finally, but it took 6 months of hard struggle. My mind creature was tenacious to hold on to life. There's nothing strange in the fact that I may have created my own hallucination. Interesting point is that in these cases of materialization, others see the thought forms that have been created. So take careful note of Alexander David Neal's words. Remember, when we create a tulpa, we do so at our own peril. It's all too easy to unleash the genie from the bottle, but it's quite a different thing to put the genie back in the bottle, or, shall we say, try to put the genie back into the bottle. We're from creatures of the mind, let's turn to creatures of the sky. If you make mention of unidentified flying objects, it'll likely conjure up imagery of flying saucers, diminutive, black-eyed, large-headed extraterrestrials, and alien abductions. At least some UFOs have absolutely nothing to do with the visitors from faraway solar systems and galaxies. That brings you to the world of a man by the name of Trevor James Constable. Having investigated the UFO phenomena extensively, he wrote 2 books on the subject. They Live in the Sky was published in 1958, and Sky Creatures followed 2 decades later. In studying UFO phenomena, he came to a fascinating conclusion concerning what he believed to be the truth about the mystery surrounding flying saucers. His conclusion was that UFOs are not nuts and bolts craft from distant worlds, but actually they're living creatures that inhabit the highest levels of the Earth's atmosphere. And while many UFO investigators scoffed at his undeniably unique ideas, nobody could deny his theory was well thought out. Describing them as critters, he believed the creatures to be unicellular and amoeba-like, but having a metallic-like outer skins that gave them their flying saucer-style appearances. He also believed it varied in size from extremely small to lengths approaching half a mile. And that admittedly accords with what UFO witnesses tell us. The assumed alien craft that people have reported do indeed vary from a few inches to massive so-called motherships. If the skies of our planet are constantly populated by an untold number of airborne critters, why don't we see them? And why don't we see them on a regular basis? Well, Constable had a notable and engaging theory for this as well. He believed the aerial things reflect infrared light, which is not visible to the naked human eye. But he also believed the creatures can change color, make something that explains why they are occasionally seen, and sometimes they are seen quite out of the blue. It's not a case that they're here 1 minute and gone the next. According to him, that's only how it appears. They're always here in massive numbers. We just can't physically see them in their natural state. He's also concluded this theory explains why some UFO witnesses have photographed UFOs, but hadn't seen anything out of the ordinary when they took the pictures. In other words, when it comes to Constable Sky Critters, the camera can see what the human eye can't. He believed even though the sky beast possessed formidable powers that allowed it to remain out of sight, for the most part, it could be seen and photographed if one specifically used an infrared film and a suitable filter. And he even put his theories into practice in the heart of the Mojave Desert. He claimed to have had considerable success in California's Lucerne Valley. He didn't shy away from publishing his photos, which continued to provoke a great deal of debate and at times unbridled fury among UFO faithful. But it is important to note, though, that his claims did not stand alone. In May of 1977, a UFO investigator named Richard Toronto, who had developed a fascination for Constable's theories, decided to try and replicate the Constable's photos in the Mojave Desert. And he claimed he had considerable success. As with Constable's pictures, which some researchers felt showed nothing stranger than aircraft landing lights and stars and planets, which, of course, are down-to-earth claims, so the anomalies, and everybody comes up with them. At least they did amongst those UFO enthusiasts who didn't want to see their cherished extraterrestrial theories questioned. And there's another theory for what both Trevor James Constable and Richard Toronto photographed, and it is a fascinating one, which is postulated by the late UFO and paranormal investigator D. Scott Rogo. It was his opinion, or should we say his strong suspicion, that both men had unknowingly created the sky monster from the depths of their imaginations and subconscious. And their psychic ability allowed them to project their mind monsters externally to the point that when they had quasi-independent lives could even be caught on camera. Whatever the truth of the matter might be, decades after he first began formulating his undeniably alternative theory about what UFOs might be, Trevor James Constable still retains a faithful following that believes our skies are not filled with extraterrestrials, but with large flying amoeba-like monsters. Well, everybody has an opinion. Interested to see who eventually turns out to have the correct opinion. Well, on that note, we run out of time. Not only for tonight's show, but for the week as well. So we shall see you when next we take to the microphone. Until then, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show, saying have a truly great evening.